Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Chris Hutting. Let's get into the first news story of today, and that is this absolutely amazing quote from the ANC's National Working Committee meeting with the National Executive Committee of the ANC that took place recently, which is, according to News 24, the DA is making us look bad. ANC top brass say GNU partner successes are showing them up. The fascinating little story about the internal discussions within the ANC that apparently many of the ANC senior leaders are concerned that the DA has been making them look bad on the national stage. The National Working Committee and its assessment of the GNU ahead of this week's meeting of the National Executive Committee has found the ANC needs to invest in competent communicators to compete with the DA's, quote, strategic communications. A National Working Committee member anonymously told News 24 that they were concerned that DA ministers were outperforming their ANC counterparts. They cited, for example, the DA Minister of Public Works, Dean McPherson, revealing just days after assuming office that cyber criminals had looted 300 million rand from the department over 10 years, and also making bold announcements, including plans to demolish the construction mafia and relocate government offices to city centers. They also talked about Gate McKenzie from the Patriotic Alliance, publishing a list of artists on social media who had gotten COVID-19 relief funds, and also announcing the department would no longer fund international trips for superfans as being things that boosted their, gave them good news coverage and a populist appeal. The source told News 24, the DA ministers came out as much more aggressive and much more competent, much more dedicated to making sure they succeeded. We saw this when they had to present budgets. Those budgets were prepared by the directors generals who were appointed by the ANC. So we are asking, why can't our ministers do these things? Unfortunately, we have not employed competent communicators, and the DA has a very good communication strategy. They communicate far better than us. We also decided that our people must rein in ministers who are not communicating the government's successes. There was also a comment in the story about how this person believes that ANC ministers are actually afraid of the media and therefore often will try to not have to do media interviews. So, Chris, this is kind of fascinating, and I'm sure it's making everyone in the DA's headquarters sort of giggle with glee. But I think what's kind of interesting here is, on one hand, you know, the ANC is... They're not even considering the possibility that maybe their ministers are being outperformed because they're not up to the task, not motivated enough, too kind of kept back in the old ways of doing things, too complacent. What do you make of this story?
So the biggest maybe issue for the ANC here is to focus on the quote-unquote effective comms and having the right people in those positions versus having the right sort of things or the wins to actually communicate. So if you've got your communicators, your administrators, your systems in place to push out those communications effectively, that's one thing. But are your ministers, your representatives as the ANC actually doing the work that can then be communicated? So they shouldn't lose sight and only think it's only about maybe smoke and mirrors, but actually focus on getting the basics right. And I want to reinforce that point around basics, basics, basics. For in a lot of these examples, not as though the DA ministers and representatives are proposing silver bullet solutions, reinventing the wheel. It's just a case of going back to basics, where for the ANC, in the position that they've become used to as the majority party, access to state resources and patronage, influence, always the biggest political force since 1994, maybe that burden of incumbency or that the comfort of incumbency, you then within that you become very comfortable with how you're conducting yourself. You don't question, are you actually doing what you should as a public servant, given the position that you've been given by voters and South African citizens. So going back to what can they effectively do, what is their role, what they're responsible for with the salaries that they receive and the perks they receive. And here again, this is not to say this solves all of South Africa's problems, but this does put a notch in the W column for the GNU, where slowly but surely you see a little bit of a shifting of narratives, of thinking, of questioning of those involved. I'm not saying everyone within the party is going to change their minds about core policy matters or ideological matters, But it just starts to shift the ground a little bit and open up those spaces for conversations, which wouldn't have taken place before this year's elections.
Right. You know, you can't just message your way out of, you know, decades of poor performance in governments. So I think, you know, while it's not clear that the DA has really, in practical terms, outperformed the ANC yet, I wouldn't expect them to, even if they were the most competent people in the world. You know, been 1 month since the cabinet was announced. But communications are an important part, to be sure. And I think the DA is showing its strengths here by managing to out-communicate the ANC. But when it comes down to it, the ANC can't just release more press statements or talk to the media more, because they're going to have to answer difficult questions. And you have to have good answers to those questions if you want to actually be able to turn people around on how you're doing in government. So, yeah, I completely agree. There's definitely a space here for the GNU to genuinely improve governance, as we both see the ANC and DA try to outcompete each other in terms of who can perform better in government. And that can only be good for South Africans in general, to see our politicians being responsive and try to earn our vote, which is exactly how our democracy should work. Okay, let's move to another story. And this is about Western Cape Premier Alan Windey, who says that the Western Cape is being shortchanged in its provision of resources by the national government. He said that the Western Cape is now the third most populous province. Even not that long ago, the Western Cape was the fifth most populous province, but is now up to third place with a population of almost 7.5 million people, and that something like 150,000 new residents are settling in the province every single year, which means it is also one of the fastest growing. Windey says that despite this, they're still only getting the fifth largest allocation from national government in terms of provincial allocations to each province. But more than that, he says it's not just that the Western Cape is being shortchanged. He believes that the Gauteng and KZN, which of course the two other biggest provinces, are also being shortchanged. In fact, Gauteng and KZN by themselves have about 45% of South Africa's population. So if you add in the Western Cape to that, you've got, you know, more than half of all South Africans living in those three provinces. And I think this is undeniably true, that there's been this sort of argument out there that the poorer provinces aren't able to raise money themselves, and therefore they need to be allocated more, even as their services continue to decline and as more and more South Africans are moving away from South Africa's smaller provinces, from the Free State, from Limpopo, from Northwest, from the Eastern Cape, to move to the big cities in KZN and Gauteng, and especially in the Western Cape. Chris, what's your take on this?
Yeah, I think as the government in general is under more fiscal pressure, you've got a higher debt to GDP ratio that has been increasing the last few years, but also coupled with a higher interest rate environment. So it's difficult for governments, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, to take on more debt. Their credit ratings have declined, so there's less fiscal room to spend more, and then, of course, to also borrow more from international bodies like the IMF, the World Bank, maybe now in other cases, the BRICS Bank, and some others. So you're going to run into the tighter fiscal position, which then filters down to national government having to maybe balance its interest where it is spending. So you've got to pay back your debt on the one hand, your interest on your debt. On the other hand, you as government need to spend on things like infrastructure, schooling, healthcare, other priorities for your citizens who are experiencing more and more economic pressures of their own. Within that broader context, then you have the current situation where you've got one province that on many metrics is performing better than most of the other provinces, not only in terms of population growth, but quality of life, GDP per capita, employment rate, job opportunities being created, infrastructure investment. There was a new table shared recently on social media indicating how much the city of Cape Town plans to invest over the next 3 to 5 years in bulk infrastructure, things like water infrastructure, versus cities like Johannesburg and Durban, where Johannesburg, as the heart of the economic heartland of the country, should enjoy much more fiscal spending power, as it were, and bigger budgets to allocate. So if that's then your pressure point, where your one province, which is governed by an opposition party, is doing better, then you as national government, governed by up until this year's elections, governed by one other party, you run into those tension points and those considerations. So I'm not directly saying there's something maybe malicious behind it, but there are these sort of incentives and these allocation priorities around spending, where does the money go, et cetera, et cetera. There's, of course, an opportunity here for the Western Cape provincial government to look at I don't want to call it alternative sources of funding, but just how do you deal with this particular issue to still then deliver, you know, good quality of life to your citizens where you can as a provincial government. You have certain rights under the constitution. There are other things that aren't part of the constitution. So work within those and make sure that those are communicated to the citizens there who are ultimately taxpayers in your province. And I think that adds to your support then and your credibility within that province. And it sends a sort of signal to people in other provinces around how you govern, how, yes, you've got fiscal constraints. There's the tension between national and provincial, but you're trying to do what you can with what you have. So it's, you know, that idea of cutting your cloth, your suit according to how much cloth you have. You don't overpromise and underdeliver. You see what the issues are. You focus on priorities and you move on from there. But overall, I do think the Premier does have a point. It just depends on now how the Western Cape provincial government deals with this. It's the reality. Now you deal with it accordingly.
It's also worth mentioning that there is, of course, a political dimension to all of this too, not just because the Western Cape is controlled by the DA outright right now, but also that if you look at those three provinces, Gauteng, KZN, and the Western Cape, those are also the three provinces where the ANC has been having the toughest time electorally. And I think that there is a bit of an incentive for the ANC to continue to make sure that its strongholds, which are the more rural provinces with the shrinking populations, are the ones that are getting a higher than perhaps they should share of the national budget, because that's kind of the basis of their support now. So that's also something to consider and perhaps challenge the ANC over, because, you know, so far, despite higher spending per person on in some of those provinces, we haven't actually really seen much of an improvement in services at all in those provinces. Okay. Let's move into international news a bit. And the Middle East seems to be hotting up again. We've recently seen the Israeli government carried out targeted strikes to assassinate senior members of some of its opponents. I believe a guy who's been described by some as one of the most important figures, if not the second in command, of the Lebanese militant group that's controlled by Iran, Hezbollah, was killed in an Israeli strike in Beirut recently. And Ismail Haniyeh, who is the Hamas leader, political leader at least, not based in the Gaza Strip. In fact, he's been living in Qatar or in Iran since 2017, was also killed in an Israeli strike shortly after they targeted Hezbollah. This seems to be the Israelis kind of making a very bold move here. Tensions have been rising recently with Hezbollah, and there has been some speculation that Hezbollah and Israel may end what has been a sort of relatively low-grade war between the two on the northern border of Israel, and that this will turn into a full-fledged regional conflict. I think things were made much worse when recently 12 children in the Golan Heights who are under the protection of the Israelis were killed by a Hezbollah rocket while playing soccer. That certainly did not make people feel much better, and that ratcheted up tensions a lot. So I guess now the world waits to see what will happen, whether Iran and its allies will retaliate against Israel for these attacks. This may be Israel kind of drawing the line and saying, don't mess with us, because we can strike you wherever you are. Chris, what do you make of this? Looks like... I think we're really in the kind of limbo now about whether this is going to be the sort of climax of tensions or whether this is going to be only the beginning of a further round of ratcheting up. What do you think?
And a part of the wider calculus here on the part of Israel might be in the context of Prime Minister Netanyahu's recent visit to Washington, concerns from Israel's part around what role the US is playing or will be willing to play both during and after the upcoming presidential elections. So as Israel, what role, what sort of stall do you set out for yourself? I'm sure the US will still remain probably their closest ally, but there could be questions around what form that allyship takes in terms of support, munitions, financial aid, and otherwise. So that could be part of your calculus. And then secondly, given maybe support that is provided to Iran by other countries, what do you as Israel do regionally to set your, to sort of set any red lines, if there are any, that you don't forget what was done to you and to your people, that you make sure that that standard is always maintained, that that level, if I can call it, of reciprocity of force, that's always in the minds of the Iranian leaders, and whatever instructions or guidance they might give to their proxies, such as Hezbollah and the Houthis as well, should not be forgotten. The Houthis continue to operate, continue to disrupt global shipping. That will put pressure, continue to put pressure on the global economy. And if Iran becomes directly involved, what that does to oil prices and the like, I don't think we want to really deal with. So it's all, I think, part of regionally wanting to secure and set out as much as you can, but also maybe in terms of global geopolitics for Israel, trying to ensure that it is not, you know, it's not put on the back burner, as it were, by some of its allies.
So we'll wait and see what comes of this. I think the Americans are very eager to avoid a big conflagration right now. And I don't know about Iran. They're very difficult to tell what is going on there. But I don't think they necessarily want to engage in a full-scale war with Israel right now. So maybe this will be followed by some ratcheting down by both sides. But we shall have to see. Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you found the show interesting. We'll be back tomorrow. That's a wrap.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.